How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
Back from the brink, and now the Celtics have a chance to tie this up. Let's talk about it.
It's time. You want the best Celtics talk around? Here it is. This is the Rain and Jays podcast. Here's John and Jay.
Yeah, the sky is no longer falling. Everything is working the way it's supposed to be. Brad Stevens is a genius making the lineup changes that Jay King had suggested. He listens to the Rain and Jays. We know that now. The things that we say get implemented. Jay King, I turn this over to you immediately to bask in your Jonas Jerebko glory. Take it away.
Yep. It started with the tip dunk, and it ended with 11 points, 12 rebounds, and complete validation for the Rain and Jays podcast, which has said since before game one that this was a Jerebko series. I didn't know it would be like a 37-minute game Jerebko series. I didn't know it would be one of those type of series where starting Jonas Jerebko would change the tides. I didn't know Avery Bradley was going to get hurt, Kelly Olynyk was going to get hurt, and Jerebko was going to end up randomly as the Celtics' best non-Isaiah Thomas shooter. But here we are, and Jonas Jerebko is important offensively. He's important defensively. And he might have changed the series
could
around.
Could be. I mean, we said, you definitely said it before the series started that this could be a Jerebko series. And we said after game one that, you know, if Olynyk is hurt, that we need to start thinking about putting Jerebko into the starting lineup. And he did. And so since we're bragging about things, I did say that Evan Turner might be a really important guy. And Evan Turner did have a big game three. The crossover, I forget who we tripped up. I forget whose ankles he broke.
Jeff Teague.
The crossover and stare down of Jeff Teague was great. That was so much fun. But a lot of good things happening. A lot of good things out there. And Stevens has the sack to try all of these things. Here we are in a pivotal do-or-die game three. You lose this game, forget it. And you start to hear people. I was asked the other day if the Celtics are playing for pride. You lose two games on the road in a seven-game series, you have an opportunity to come back and play in game one and game three, your first game at home, and change the tone. But people were already, the way the Celtics had lost games one and two, they already were saying, are we just playing for pride here? Are we horribly overmatched? So what does Stevens do in game three? He puts a lineup out there where RJ Hunter and Terry Rozier are in the backcourt together in the first half. That guy's got some balls, man. I mean, he's out there just putting these guys out there in these situations, and it's working out. Like, Terry Rozier is hitting some shots. Hunter, not as effective as Rozier. He's making some nice passes, and he's rebounding a little bit. His defense is eh, and, you know, he needs to get that shot going. But still, he's out there, and it's not killing them. So, got to give props to Stevens for mixing and matching and having it work out.
Yeah, although he kind of needed to. When you shoot 34% in games one and two, and it's clear Jarrett Sullinger has just doesn't have the right matchups for this series, you needed to switch up that starting lineup. And obviously, I don't blame him for starting big the first two games because you can't really switch up your starting lineup out of that you've used for the last 70 games and got you to the playoffs and got you tied for the third best record in the East without any proof that it's not going to work. But I mean, he yanked them within 4 minutes in each of the first two games. He knew the small lineup was going to be the best lineup, and he went with it in game three. And the Celtics just played so much better. And now, you know, if they can pull out game four, go back to Atlanta, and who knows what the hell happened. By the way, Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah,
let's just talk about
Isaiah Thomas.
We're going
to get to that. Absolutely.
we can't waste too much time before getting to Isaiah Thomas, who had an absolutely monster game three. That, I mean, 42 points.
On what? And it was an efficient 23 shots, right?
24, I believe. And, I mean, he got to the free throw line 16 times. He hit 5 threes. That was an absolutely monster career night from him. And best part of that night to me was seeing him in a suit, because he never wears a damn suit. He wears sweats to games. He showed up in a suit. I asked him why. He said, "I wear suits to important nights, and this was one of those nights." And that was perfect. That was like, yeah. Yeah, he knew that was a big night, and then he went out and got 42.
Look, this is all connected, obviously, because when you are able to hit the shots early, so you start Jarebko and Turner, those two things really assisted in Isaiah Thomas getting a lot of those looks, because they played a lot more of Thomas off the ball to get him into positions and with matchups that allowed him to take advantage of his skills. And you have Jarebko out there hitting threes. When guys are hitting threes, I know even Jay Crowder, who had one of the worst shooting nights in the world, but in the first half, he actually hit one of those threes. So when those guys are all hitting and you have to at least respect their shot, that opens things way up for Isaiah Thomas. So now all of a sudden he's getting to the rim and he has lanes to finish. He has a little sliver of daylight to finish. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, because they didn't have that. It was, like I said in the last show, it looked like a Syracuse 2-3 zone out there in games 1 and 2. And all of a sudden, now there's space. And when there is space, Isaiah Thomas will take advantage of that space. And, yeah, he took advantage of it in a huge way in game 3.
Yeah, that was a performance for the ages. Considering, you know, that's basically a must-win game in game 3. And people had started chirping, "Oh, Isaiah can't do it in the playoffs." "Oh, yeah, guys? Oh, I can't?" "Here, 42 big ones, jerks." Now he's leading the whole NBA in playoff points per game. People were chirping that. He had 27 points in game 1. He was their only hope to score in game 1. And people were still chirping because he had a rough game 2. And you don't stop Isaiah Thomas from scoring for long. It doesn't matter what defense you have. And the Hawks have the very best defense after the All-Star break. Doesn't matter. 42. Good luck trying to stop me, guys. Thanks.
So let's look at what's sustainable from game 3. Because that big thing, and you see the headlines all over the place, can the Celtics carry the momentum into game 4? There's no really such thing as momentum from game to game. Though there is confidence, and confidence in your shooting, and Jay Crowder went and spent time in the gym at 1:30 in the morning the other night to try and get his confidence back. So what's sustainable here? Obviously, Isaiah Thomas isn't going to be dropping 42 points a game in this series. He might try, but also, Jay Crowder's not going to shoot 10% either. Right? I mean, that's...
You hope. I mean,
so that's going to balance out, right? You mean you're probably going to get at least 12 or 14 from Crowder to offset when Isaiah Thomas goes back down to scoring 27, which is awesome, but still it's not 42. Somebody else is going to have to step up and make up that difference so the Celtics can score.
Yeah, I mean, you would hope it'd be Crowder, but he just really hasn't been the same. And when he went to the gym the other night, I started thinking about a podcast between Kyle Korver and J.J. Redick. Obviously, those are two of the best shooters in the game today, two of the best shooters probably of all time. And during their podcast, they talked a lot about how much they had to adjust their shot when they had injuries. And they said it just really threw things off, at least for a while, before they kind of adjusted and learned how to adjust. And maybe that's what Crowder needed to do, and maybe that's going to the gym will help him. He said he needs to get a little more lift on his shot to compensate for the ankle. And, you know, maybe he just needed a little extra work. Maybe he needed to be that crazy guy who should probably be resting his sprained ankle that's still swollen and won't stop being swollen until after the season. He probably should have been resting that. But instead, there he is at 1:30 a.m. getting an extra 45-minute workout. And, you know, that's the type of mentality you want in a player. And we'll see if it works out. But, you know, if Kyle Korver and J.J. Redick, if it's that hard for them to
Right.
adjust,
Right.
it's going to be hard for Jay Crowder to adjust too, because he's not nearly as good a shooter as
No.
those guys. But the Celtics do need him to knock down shots because, as you said, Isaiah's not going to get 42
Right.
every game.
The thing, yeah, it's Crowder is a league average 3-point shooter. That's his thing. Like he can hit at about 34%, which is better than 10% or whatever he's shooting now. But he'll get it back. He'll get it back. I have confidence that he will get it back. One of the things that he is doing, though, is he's forcing the turnovers. So that's the good thing, is that he's playing the defense throughout all of this. And I will give you credit that. And after the Game 2 podcast, you said, look, the Celtics still force a lot of turnovers, but they got 6 points off of those turnovers in Game 2, I believe it was. And I forget what the number is for Game 3, but it was a lot more. The points off of turnovers really, really helped. And if Crowder is going to contribute in any way during this shooting slump, that's the way to do it. Cause the turnovers, start the break, and lead the defense, because that defense is really where you're going to win these games. They're not outscoring a lot of teams. If you go into a shootout, you're not going to win a shootout. And it also helps that Kyle Korver, speaking of Kyle Korver, was in foul trouble. Because when he wasn't in foul trouble and when he was on the floor, he's a big, big problem for the Celtics. So that'll lead me into one of our Twitter questions using the hashtag RaininJays without the G, J King. RaininJays without the G. We don't use G's. We use apostrophes like the cool kids. Let's see. We have a question here. It was, oh. From at Connor T. Sharp, or yeah. Are we better off having Smart defending Teague or Korver? Who's the bigger threat? And the and Smart had a lot of time late in the game just hounding Korver, which almost feels like a waste because you should be able to guard Kyle Korver with someone other than Smart, and you leave Smart on a guy that's like a Teague. Or even a Schroeder who can penetrate. And Schroeder was killing the Celtics with the penetration and getting shots at the rim in game three. So, what would you rather see?
Smart actually had a lot of trouble with Korver in the fourth quarter. Atlanta was setting some monster screens, and Smart's normally incredible at getting over screens. And I think that's part of the reason why they probably do like him on Korver, because he stays attached to a guy's hip and hardly ever loses him. That fourth quarter, Korver kept getting open, and all he needs is a sliver. And it was Smart guarding him during when he went berserk early in the fourth. But still, I like that matchup. I mean, Smart, as I said, incredible at getting through screens, over screens, bowling through screens, whatever he needs to do to get through a screen. You like that matchup. I also like him on Teague, especially late when they're in the pick and roll and they're switching the pick and roll, because he does a serviceable job on Millsap. Smart does. So you can just switch that, and that gives you a lot of options against their pick and roll. So I think the moral of the story here is Smart is very helpful, and the fact that he can guard, switch on a Millsap as a 6'3" guard, which is just outrageous, by the way. He's one of the very, very few guards who could even get away with that for a few seconds at a time. But yeah, so I think I like the Teague matchup most, especially down the stretch when you're switching those pick and rolls. But I mean, also you got to account for having Isaiah Thomas out there. Who's he going to
Right.
guard? Who's Jay Crowder going to guard? He's not quite as quick laterally as he is when he's fully healthy. So there are a whole slew of issues to think through. But I think with the smaller lineups, it's a lot easier to get the matchups right, because the Celtics can just switch everything and cause a lot of havoc that
Yeah.
way. The small lineup changes a lot for the Celtics, and it's been a huge boost because Atlanta hasn't hurt that. Atlanta hasn't really gotten to the offensive glass much. Horford and Millsap really haven't gotten going. The small lineup really has not hurt the Celtics, and it's given them so much at both ends. So huge adjustment by Stevens to go completely away from traditional, and that should give them a better chance.
Yeah, and you know, Jarebko, we keep talking about his offense, but his ability to defend is really really an important thing here.
Yeah, stay in front of Teague, stay in front of Schroeder in the switches. John is still hurting from that Las Vegas trip, apparently.
I just had two nights in Vegas, and I'm still like nursing a little bit of a hangover 2 days later. But no, we're good. We're good. This is what you do. You step up your game.
Yep. This is playoff
podcasting.
We're not screwing around here.
We're not screwing around.
You come back from Vegas. You fly in. You hop on Skype to record Rain and Jay's.
That's right.
The people.
The people demand it. So let's talk a little bit, because Amir Johnson's defense is something that I haven't seen anything about, but I think Amir Johnson was huge in game three. Like, he had some big blocks, he chipped in offensively, but his offense, his help defense, I mean, his help defense was just huge. And I think that should get a little bit of shine in this world. We're talking about like small lineups and everything, but yeah. I think Amir should get a little bit of love for what he did out there.
I think the only reason he's not is because that's been pretty consistent for like the past 2 months. Whereas Jarebko went from season high of 26 minutes in the regular season to now all of a sudden it's a critical game three and he's starting having 37 minutes, getting his first double-double, I believe, of the season. And so it's just like, and then Isaiah had 42. So I think all the new stuff overshadowed the fact that Amir Johnson, like he has been for the past month or two, was very good defensively again. And he's been huge for them. And the fact that, like some of those other guys, he has a little versatility and he can he can't switch on to guys like Jarebko does, but he does a pretty good job of staying in front of guys when he needs to. And he can guard even most small ball fours. So Amir Johnson, He's been very, very helpful over the past couple of months, and he should be moving forward. It's weird because you get into the playoffs, and he was the guy like, okay, got to be worried about Amir Johnson's health. And now it's the playoffs, and like everybody else is hurting, and there's Amir Johnson completely healthy and absolutely making a difference. So that I guess his injury issues – Good work there by the Celtics training staff.
Yeah, the Celtics training staff, I don't know, we keep getting these questions about people wondering about their whether.
Yeah, I've heard some them taking
it's,
some
it's
heat.
Ridiculous. I don't want to acknowledge that too much because it's ridiculous. These guys have been by and large pretty healthy this year. We talked about it the last show. Brings me to one of our Twitter questions from Aaron, who, in addition to this comment about what we were just talking about, I like the changes. I like that he, Brad Stevens, is not afraid to change when he knows what isn't working. And I like the players. I like that the players go with it. So there's that comment. And then she has this question. Do you think all of the injuries to everyone, including Steph Curry, is now because the season is too long and too hard on their bodies? Which is a huge point of emphasis in the NBA. The analytics guys aren't just looking at statistics. They're looking at things like minutes and miles and all of this mileage on these players' bodies, to the point where the NBA is adjusting the schedule and not playing as many back-to-backs next year, because some of this is that the body wears down. At some point, the body can only take so much, and these guys are in prime physical condition, and they are as fit as you can be, but even they have the potential for injuries if they're out there doing too much. Now, that's not to say that Avery Bradley's pulled hamstring has anything to do with what he's been through. It might. I don't know if guys are more likely to sprain an ankle just because their bodies can't, I don't know, hold them together or something. Some of these injuries are just injuries that happen. But there are things. There are definite injuries across the league that just at this point, guys are going to get hurt because they've been going for months and months and months, and they're playing their 86th, 87th game. And by the time you reach the championship, you're playing your 100th NBA game. So, yeah, some of these injuries, yeah, because the season is too long and hard on their bodies, I definitely believe that. But I think, like, Isaiah Thomas's wrist, that I think is something that over the grind of a season, stuff like that is something that happens. You have to keep an eye on, and that's where the training staff comes in to keep that in check, those little nagging things, and make sure that that doesn't become an issue, that they get their treatment and that it's just a little nagging thing and not a big problem. Some injuries, like a sprained ankle, that stuff happens. But, yeah, so and the NBA is going to continue to make changes, and they continue to monitor that stuff. So you're going to hear a lot about the injuries and the schedule and everything moving forward as the NBA becomes more transparent and announces more things in an effort to control that.
All right.
There we go.
Dr. John Corrales. With the update there.
Yeah, well, it's true. Okay.
Yeah.
Next topic then, unless you have something to add.
No, I got nothing to add. Nothing there.
Alex asks, how do you feel about the C's three-point defense? Are the Hawks just missing?
I think the Celtics have done a very good job with the exception of first quarter of, what was it?
Two.
Game two on Kyle Korver. And fourth quarter of game four, although Korver hit some tough shots then, I think they've done a really good job of forcing the guys you want to shoot on the Hawks to shoot. And the playoffs have a way of exposing the shooters that don't have utmost confidence. Like if you can remember the way the Cleveland Cavaliers played the Warriors in the finals last year, they were daring Draymond Green to shoot. And Draymond Green is a very capable shooter. But he hadn't developed that utmost confidence that the best shooters have. And he was inside of his head for like the first two games and needed to snap out of that and completely get a different mindset moving forward. But it's just like guy like Kent Bazemore, he's missing some shots, but he's not like one of those born shooters. He's a built shooter. And I think guys like that have a different mentality. And so the Celtics are making the guys shoot out of rhythm shots. And a very good job, although Bazemore's had a really good series. He's a great cutter. Bazemore is a fantastic cutter. He's beating them on back cuts like eight times through three games. He is – I love watching that man cut.
That's such a basketball nerd thing to say. I know exactly what you're talking about. I know exactly what you're talking about. And yes, but like no one that isn't just – completely immersed in the game of basketball, no one would ever say that. I love watching that man cut. It's just funny. It's like such an obscure thing to like, but it's true. It's true. Look, I think the Celtics three-point defense is it's a pick your poison in some regards because they do have so many guys that can hit that shot. You have to just say this is the guy that if he's going to burn us, then he's going to burn us because you have to try to stay tight on Korver. It's not as easy, and I don't want to be the guy that complains too much about moving screens, but, you know, sometimes, whew, there are some moving screens out there. So it's a little harder to get around those, but...
Horford sets a mammoth screen.
Horford, for some reason, gets, like, the KG-level treatment where you can just slide way out and get the benefit of the doubt. Just, I don't know, whatever, but... When that's happening and you're not getting that call, then, yeah, that makes guarding Korver a lot more difficult. But, yeah, look, you got to chase Korver around. Korver runs around the floor. You're not just getting off over one pick. You've got to get around two or three. And he does a real good job of setting up the picks. That's the other thing, that the good shooters don't just come off of picks. The good shooters know when to set the guy up, when to change speeds, what angles to come off of the screens. Like, all of those little things come into being a great shooter like that. You don't just run around in a circle and wait for Al Horford to slide and set the illegal screen. You set that guy up. So, and then you get yourself into a point where your mechanics are just so automatic that as soon as he has an opening, it's unreal. It's unreal. But I think in general, the Celtics have done okay. There are a couple of instances where a guy like, I did note one thing, RJ Hunter, you got to know who's out there. Like, RJ Hunter had one closeout on Schroeder, who is not a good three-point shooter. Like, that's the guy you want out there. And he closed that way too hard on him. Schroeder went by. And that's the play that he got the flagrant one on. So
yeah,
that is something that defensively, and look, if Hunter's in there, he's got to understand. If Schroeder's out there in the three-point line, you don't give him the open shot. But you don't close out on him so hard to a point where you just let him fly right by you. You got to let him make that decision. And if he wants to shoot the three, fine. But you can't put your other teammates in a position. Now, that ended up in a flagrant one. But if it didn't, and he took the layup, or he could make a pass in that situation, now you've got the entire team in rotation, and that's when you start losing guys. So if they can do those little things right, even the rookies, they have to do it when they're in there, then they'll be much better. But they can't be making silly mistakes like that and not recognizing who's on the floor. You have to know your personnel. So still things that they have to work on, but it's also RJ Hunter, who isn't out there that much. So he's going to make some mistakes. Okay, next question. Okay, Alexander, would we consider at least two playoff wins against Atlanta a successful advertisement for Horford-level players this offseason in free agency? I think that we are already, if you're a free agent and you're not at least impressed enough with what Boston has done all year long, then if they win tonight, that's not going to change anybody's mind. I don't think any free agent, let's just say Al Horford, I don't think Al Horford is sitting there going like, I don't know, let's see what they do in this one more game. I think you either know or you don't. Like, if you are inclined to answer Danny Ainge's phone call and let him and Brad Stevens pitch you in July, then you've already made up your mind as Boston is one of those destinations. And if you're not, then Boston is just completely off your radar no matter what. They could win tonight by 100. And they're just, if you've decided, then you've decided. So I don't think tonight is really...
Yeah.
But?
I think that's probably right. And guys in the NBA, you know, media might overreact to a first-round loss. But guys around the NBA know, like, okay, Avery Bradley's out. That's a huge loss. Kelly Olynyk's out. That's important too. Like, these guys are starting Jonas Jerebko and competing like heck, you know, like it's not like they look at it like blowhard media guys do. So yeah, I think the Celtics have done enough to impress free agents. It's just there are other factors too, and it's not going to necessarily be that Kevin Durant ends up in Boston, but I don't think losing to Atlanta, and teams know Atlanta's really good too. It's not like Atlanta's like some bummy team. And again, Celtics got really unlucky to play Atlanta on the road. Like that was, I really do think that was the worst possible matchup for Boston. And now they just got to try to make it a series. They could even the series tonight. And then who knows? Right. Who knows? And if they somehow beat Atlanta though, if they do beat Atlanta without Avery Bradley, I mean, that's like a magical win.
Yeah.
That guys, I do think guys will take note of that. Like, how the heck do they do that?
That would be, I mean, you talk about raising Brad Stevens' stock. Brad Stevens would get all the credit in the world for that. Although, yeah. I mean, it's always on the players, but that would be like, you know, if they come through and win, let's say they win in game 7, you know that that's going to be, how did Brad Stevens get his guys to do this? That's going to be the headline.
Yeah, and I mean, he definitely would deserve some credit for going to Jerebko as a start. I mean, Jerebko was out of the Pistons rotation last year. Like, the Pistons, right. And the Pistons need someone just like Jerebko. Like, that's who they want, like stretch fours who can defend. And he was out on the outskirts of the rotation there, and now here he is, critical Jonas Jerebko in the playoff series for a legitimate team. It's unreal. I mean, their whole team is like that, but Jerebko is just right now the highlight of their like band of misfits that has grown together to have synergy and emerge in NBA
Yeah,
glory.
it's crazy. It's crazy. And I still see people, because you're never going to get 100% buy-in on anything. I still see people tweeting that Brad Stevens is overrated. I don't know why they think that, but I don't know what more this guy can do other than go out there and hit shots himself. So, all right.
Maybe that's the next
Maybe.
step.
One more topic that I think we should talk about before we wrap things up and send this podcast out into the world. Marcus Smart making winning plays.
Oh my God, that was the quote of the century.
Making winning. Now, I can see what he's trying to say. I really can, because
Yeah, no,
whoever had five
I agree
fouls,
with it 'cause
you're trying to get him out of the game. So, and look, I said earlier, the Korver foul trouble was a huge part of this, because he had burned them so badly in game two. To come in game three and have him just sit on the bench for so long. And we saw when he actually got a little bit of time that he was going to start torching them again. So, yeah, Marcus Smart went out there and said, "Here's an opportunity for me to draw a foul on him." And he just did it in the most spectacular, floppy way that you can flop. Like the floppiest flop you can ever flop. That's what that was. But, and I wrote this morning on the website. I'm done with telling Marcus Smart, stop flopping, because that's not going to happen. That's just who he is. He is a flopper.
Yeah.
So my message to Marcus Smart is, at least make it believable, man. At least make it seem like it's believable.
No. I'm on board with the full-blown flop.
You
Like,
want
if
performance
you're gonna
art.
flop and it's not gonna get called, you might as well go over the top and look like a fish jumping out of water. There was that wrestling meme on the internet where he's getting
You get like the Stone
like
Cold
body
Stunner
slammed
or
to the
something.
ground. That was unreal. I mean, that was I watched that 50 times and laughed every single time.
He did.
That was just an
He looked like a marlin
unreal
getting
flop.
reeled
And
in.
then to come to the media, then to address the media about it and just say I was just trying to make winning plays to help my team. That was perfect, man.
No shame. No shame in his game, Marcus Smart.
It's just great, and he's just trying to make winning plays, and it's true, and that's what makes it so funny. Like there he is, like flinging himself into the air and looking like he's waving his arms like he just got shoved off a building or something,
Seriously.
and he's just trying to make winning plays,
I
man.
know. It's fun.
Man,
It
Marcus
was
Smart.
really funny to watch. And you watch it, like you watch it happening live, you're like, "What the hell just happened there?" And then you watch the replay and you just, "Oh, Marcus. Oh, Marcus. What are you?"
Those are the plays where, when you're watching live, like I don't have the benefit of TV when I'm watching the games. So I watch that and I'm like, man, Korver got him.
He fooled you. He
He got
got you.
hammered. And then 2 seconds later, like the vine hits the internet, and I'm like,
Yeah.
all right. Oh man, I mean that was
Yep.
unbelievable. He just that was maybe the funniest flop I've ever seen. I think there have been more egregious flops by people before,
Don't know. I've seen a couple
but.
where I know there's the Chris Paul one where he kind of grabs who was it? I forget who it was. A big guy, and like throws himself into the big, and then flops, and he does the big twirly thing. Like that's always a funny one.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this had a lot more. Like it was organic, it was in the moment, and it was just so like twirly and flingy. And he landed pretty hard. That's the other thing. Here's a guy playing with bruised ribs, and he does that. I mean, that's really trying to make a winning play. You're really flinging yourself out
He's
there.
trying to make.
I don't know if like he was selling the fact that he was hurt there, or if his ribs actually hurt for a second. He had like a pang of regret as soon as he hit the floor, like maybe I should have slid a little bit rather than flew through the air. But
Yeah, that was one of the flat like that was the most, I would say that was the most dangerous flop I've ever seen, where he could have seriously, like, he could have hurt a wrist. He could have hurt his ribs again. He, anything, I mean, he flung himself into the air. That was, oh, man, that was just the maybe the perfect flop. I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, you got a lot to choose from him, so, yeah.
Yeah, there will be no shortage of funny Marcus Smart flops.
I don't think he's done paying
future.
Those fines. I don't think he's done paying flopping fines. And maybe not even this postseason. So sit back, I guess, and enjoy the show. I would just like to see him. If you're going to try to draw that foul, like make it look like you were actually fouled in an NBA basketball game and not hit with a bazooka. Like that's just that's just my message to him. Like
it's just part of the Marcus Smart experience, man. It's just part of the Marcus Smart
imagine
experience.
Being an official and looking at that, like what's going through the official's mind as he sees Marcus Smart flying through the air like that? Is he sitting there thinking like, really, dude? Or, you know, is he laughing a little bit inside? What's going through? That's what I want to know. I wish whenever we're going to find an official at some point to interview for this podcast, and that'd be like one of our first questions. When a player so egregiously flops and you don't give him the call, what is going through your head at that moment when you're watching this guy spin through the air like he had just been kicked by Bruce Lee? Like that, that's what I want to know. So
that fourth quarter was the whole Marcus Smart experience, though. Like he had play, he started making plays, like he showed off the improved pick and roll game. He hit a couple long jumpers to show like the streakiness. Then he took a wild, wild pull-up three on the fast break that had no chance of going in. Just one of the worst shots you'll see. Then he sped back on defense, blocked out Horford.
Oh, yeah, right. That, I mean.
Then he had the superb flop of all superb flops. Like, that was just perfect Marcus Smart fourth quarter. The good, the bad, the hilarious. It really was. I could watch Marcus Smart play basketball all day, every day, because that guy is just a roller coaster.
That's true. You can't put it any better like than that. So we're gonna leave it at that. I don't think we have any more. We got one more Twitter comment, but this is just from Jilly Conway. Remember when Rozier was a bad pick? Me neither. I like Rozier's play.
I actually don't. I do not remember when Terry Rozier was a bad pick. He was always like the athletic guy who could pan out, you know, the guy who had a lot more upside than other guys available at that stage. He's a gamer, though.
Yeah,
he's tough. I have been impressed by the way he has stepped up in the playoffs, and he doesn't force much. He's clearly not trying to step on anybody's toes, but he's knocked down shots. He's made defensive plays. He rebounds. He's athletic. There's a lot to like about
Terry
Rozier.
Absolutely. And this is when, before everybody was hurt, when I was saying that this is how I want Terry Rozier to play in the lineup where there's no Bradley. This is why I thought it wouldn't be devastating. It would be tough, but not devastating, because with Marcus Smart doing some of what Bradley does, Terry Rozier coming off the bench and hitting the shots that he's hitting and making some of the plays that he's playing, solid, totally solid. So he's actually playing pretty well, and I like what he's giving. And yeah, there is plenty to like about this kid in the future, and I think that he could have a role in the next few years. And I still say the same thing about RJ Hunter. I think RJ Hunter's passing, he makes good decisions, and the plays that he makes maybe not always going to pan out, but at least offensively, I think RJ Hunter makes good decisions, and you can see that as he gains more experience and gets stronger and better and smarter, that some of those decisions are going to pan out into some really good plays. So I like what I'm seeing.
Yeah, I think the strength is a big deal for him. Real big deal.
He's got to get stronger, definitely. And he's got things to learn. And, we can have a discussion some point over the summer about his jumper, which I love the quick release, but the release point, but whatever works. Like, it doesn't – who are you going to tell? Like,
I mean, he got blocked two times this series, but he didn't really get blocked at all the whole season.
No,
you know?
And
It's not like that was an issue at all. It's just, I think it was just randomly he got blocked twice
that
in
might
the same
be it.
Game.
That might be it. But that,
and so people
that's
will
a different
react
discussion
to.
For a different time. We have more time to discuss the future. But the present is what we're focused on. And the present is game four against the Hawks in the Garden, getting ready to send this series back to Atlanta tied at two. So everybody can shut the F up about playing for pride and all this other stuff. The Celtics are here to win. And we're here to do podcasts when they do. So we're going to do that after they win at some point, whatever our schedule is. But we'll do it. So we'll see you next time on the Rain and Jays podcast.